Hello everyone, this is the Red News Fanzine Podcast. Thank you all for listening, and thank you all for buying the mag. And if you don't buy the mag, buy the mag. But if you want to support us a little bit more, we also have a Patreon that you can sign up to, and it's patreon.com/rednews. Now, here's the podcast. Goodbye.
Everyone, it's Red News Podcast 306. The sun is out, so you're going to be sitting in beer gardens, you're going to be sitting in your garden, you're going to be sitting anywhere, and I have the perfect accompaniment to it. It's a new book by the excellent author and read Dan Williamson, If I Hadn't Seen Such Riches. It's excellent. I kindly got a preview copy, and it's just fantastic. And it was obviously my era, 20 carefree, headbags aplenty, travelling around Europe, back in Europe. But I've been told even by my wife, shut up, let Dan speak for once. So how do you feel now you've given birth?
Yeah, brilliant. It's always a long time in coming when you sort of start a book and then 2 years, and just feels like it takes forever. And then even when you finish the book, you've got probably 6 months to wait before it actually comes out, going through all the kind of final touches with the publisher. And then there's always a bit of a delay. And then it comes out and it just feels great. And to hear people receiving the copies and enjoying it. And I've gone to number one in the United category on Amazon. So I'm pretty happy with that. So yeah, I'm just delighted really.
If I Hadn't Seen Some Riches. So what helps you the best for any readers? I'm going to put the plugs obviously when I do this. What's best for you for people to buy it?
Anywhere really. Amazon, Waterstones. If people wanted a copy from me, then I could sort that out as well. Probably be a bit more expensive. So anywhere, really. I think Amazon Waterstones or from me directly.
We had a plug-in, like an extract you kind of gave for the last mag of the season, which was personal, which I loved. So it's sort of like the macro and the micro, the bigger picture, but also your relationship to it. You touch it for people who didn't buy the mag. Why didn't you buy the mag?
I think, you know, writing a book is, I remember reading years ago that, you shouldn't sort of mention anything personal in the book, in books and things like that. And I've just kind of got to the stage where I think, no, it's my book. I've spent 2 years writing and researching it and working on it. So why can't I just write the personal side of it? And, you know, just be completely honest with why I've done the book and explain why. And I think it's important in the introduction, I explain why I've done the book from a sort of personal reason, but also from a reason why I think this is important for an important period for the club and an important period for English football as well. So yeah, for me, it was, I was 8 when the final was on. So it was one of the first seasons that I really remember. I got my first replica shirt as well after the final, the replica from the final. And, it's just a really sort of memorable time for me personal. And my three books that I've done before this have been on South American football, and I just wanted to do one that was kind of a bit closer to home.
Yeah, sharing those moments with your dad, what United's about, family, you know, relationships. It's off pitch as much as on pitch, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like I say, that shirt that I was given was like a gift from my dad, and I've still kept it. It's been in the loft all these years, and I recently just bought the reissued shirt and dug the old one out of the loft and put them side by side. And yeah, it's a little bit off-coloured now. But
you know, when some things align, the kit was superb. The era was superb. The football was getting better. You know, it wasn't perfect. Just all aligned. You know, it's a great season to remember.
Yeah, no, and for me, like, I think I came of age really at the perfect time. So one of my first memories is that kind of summer of 1990, so the FA Cup final. Then you've got the World Cup as well in Italy. And then that's when I kind of really knew what was going on and fell in love with football, really. So that 1991 season was my first season where I was really following everything as much as I could, watching the games on telly when I could. And just perfect timing, really, for me as a young fan. And then my first game was the opening day of the following season at home to Notts County. So yeah, kind of very fortunate with the timing there as a youngster. Obviously, probably not as fortunate as people like you who were old enough to go to the games and you know, go to Rotterdam. I would have loved to have gone to that game. And quite a lot of people who didn't go have said that's one of the games that they wish they could go back in time. And and go to because it's just such an iconic game in the sort of history of the club.
Well, that's it. Like, you know, we have Barcelona obviously gets top of the thing, but for a certain age group, that Rotterdam just had everything. You know, like we were back, a lot of youngsters there. If you look at the photos, and what I loved about the book is it brings the off pitch and the on pitch. There's memories, there's fan memories. You know, like it was just carnage. It was just, you get out of that station and it was just a sea of very blissed up Reds, you know, like, and all the talk of the booze ban, you know, like, but it was just, it's just wonderful. It was a bottle up day, you know.
Yeah, I remember you saying like a sea of head bags at the train station.
Yeah.
You know, just like references like that, head bags, you know, that you, people wouldn't really understand unless they were around at that, in that time, what a head bag is. my favourite parts of the book actually are probably those fan stories, because it just really brings it to life. I always said when I did the book that I didn't want to just do a, you know, game by game a description of the goals and all that kind of stuff, which obviously I did, but I wanted to include more stuff about the fans, you know, what the fans were thinking at the time, the travel stories from yourself and others, and also putting the book in the wider context of what's going on in society and music and things like that. So I didn't want it to just be a football book. So obviously, you know, most of the people that will buy it and read it and enjoy it will probably be football fans, United fans, but I'm hoping that other people find it interesting as well, because I do try and touch on history as well.
But the cultural, you know, where do you stand? Was it the start of something or the end of something?
What, in terms of
football culture, you know, like, it was, for me, it was like, you could argue both. It was the end of, you know, the starting to come in final parts of where we could get away with, not, you know, get away with anything, but, you know, we didn't have all the aggro and, like, needless digital shite that we have nowadays. You know, it was the end of that, but then it was also the start of, you know, Manchester and, like, all of it coming together. So it's like, I could see the arguments for both.
Yeah, I mean, obviously for me, it was kind of the start of something because of my age. But yeah, I felt as well that, yeah, you know, things like the tick when you could pay on the gate, you know, that was obviously kind of coming to an end. The thing, the Taylor report, and the Stretford end was knocked down, wasn't it, in the 92 season. So football was obviously becoming more gentrified. So the I guess the success of things like the World Cup and football becoming safer and obviously kind of leads to things like all ticket, you know, Taylor report, all ticket matches, the Premier League and the prices rising, and the sort of so-called product and brand was obviously becoming more and more of a thing, and shirt sales and commercialization were becoming much more of a thing throughout the 90s. So I felt it was kind of like caught in between two eras. That period was kind of the end of the dark days of the sort of decrepit stadia and hooliganism, and then, but before the real commercialization and family friendly side of football, if you like. So it kind of feels like it was almost caught in the middle. That 2 or 3 year period was almost like a transition period.
But you think, like, you know, it's almost staggering when you talk to younger Reds to explain that we were banned, everyone, for 5 years. You know, it's just like, imagine that. It's just like, you know, and you were desperate every year. Every summer there'd be rumours, oh, it'd be this year, and you know, like, it'd be this year. And then it was just like, that we felt like a sense, huge sense of freedom, especially if you were young. Yes, we can actually go away, like, into Europe, which did, you know, there was just no, we didn't know what we were going to expect Montpellier. We didn't know what we were going to expect in Warsaw, which Warsaw then was totally different. There's so many subplots in the book. What surprised you the most when you did the research?
I think probably just you touched on it then, was the fear of trouble that kind of followed the whole campaign, really. The paranoia that every kind of away trip was meticulously planned by the, you know, Greater Manchester Police going over to the host countries and the club being involved, and you know, the club trying to make everyone go on official trips. Obviously, I know you and quite a lot of other people evaded those official trips, but yeah, that kind of struck me, that there was such a sort of air of paranoia throughout the whole campaign, and I did think, and I wrote this in the book, and you know, what would have happened if there was still an element of hooliganism in that time? You know, what if you know, Villa were in Europe briefly, but what if United and Villa fans had, you know, run amok in Europe and caused loads of trouble? What would have happened to English football? You know, so I kind of, it's like a bit of a sliding door thing, but, you know, I found that quite interesting, just thinking about that and reading all the stories and just how paranoid, and you know, the security operations that the other clubs put on because they were expecting, you know, this angry mob to come over and kick off, and it just never transpired. And you were one of the people that said it, and quite a few others that I spoke to just said how the atmosphere at the final was just, was real, a feel-good factor.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like maybe many people expected. So that was kind of really good, really refreshing as well. And other clubs have obviously gone around Europe causing trouble, and I suppose it kind of gives you a feeling of pride as well that the club wasn't, you know, the fans weren't dickheads, basically.
I genuinely think that was of its time as well, you know, like the smell of marijuana around Rotterdam and Amsterdam, you know, like it was genuinely like everyone was just partying, and the rave culture might have had something to do with that. So you just, because I put a thing in a WhatsApp group about the book, and someone sent a couple of papers of the fear of that final. You know, there was talk of there'd be no trains. Montpellier, they made us walk back miles and miles after the game, you know, and just everyone was really just giddy to be there. Which one trip would you have liked to have done out of that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the final, I would love to have done that, but I think Montpellier would have been pretty cool, you know, because I think that was the biggest game aside from the final. Many journalists were saying that the tie was done after that first leg. The dreaded away goal, which is no longer a thing now, but, you know, drawing at home, conceding an away goal, then going away, it was almost seen that you know, it's going to be tough now to come back from this. So it's kind of like one of those against the odds, away from home, European wins that I think most people enjoy more than any other when it comes to European run. You always kind of look back on those games and think, yeah, that's the one moment. Because I mean, obviously going to Hungary and Warsaw would have been pretty cool, but I think Montpellier was the biggest game.
And Wrexham. but it's like, there was an innocence, you know, like, again, the subplots, Blackmore, so important, final, Montpellier, you know, your minor, lesser players sort of turned up. You know, we were at the cusp, it wasn't, we were Les Seeley, you know, the god that was Seeley, but also, like, we didn't have, you know, Valderrama for Montpellier was just like this mythical figure. We didn't get to see other, so it's just like this hair and everything about it. We didn't know what to expect on any of it.
Yeah, it was just a different era, wasn't it? Like you say, you don't really, obviously there was a little bit of, you know, Fergie went to watch Montpellier and stuff like that. So there was kind of a little bit of prep, but nothing like you would do nowadays, you know, and everyone knows everything about every single player in Europe now, don't they? You know, someone does, even if you don't, but someone will, and there'll be no kind of surprises, there'll be no hidden, hidden tactics or anything. You kind of know what everyone's going to do, and yeah, so it was just a bit of a more sort of romantic time, I guess, if you like. I mean, even to the point where one of the other things that surprised me was in the first leg going to Hungary against this team that wasn't a minnow, really. You know, had a couple, the Pesky Monkeys had like a couple of seasons where they were doing all right. They were not a big team in Hungary, let alone Europe. And then Fergie picks a really defensive team for the away leg because he's like, oh, I don't know what they're going to be like. I think his phrase was something like, they could turn out to be tigers on their home patch. You know, so he puts out like a back four, then Lee Martin and Clayton Blackmore in midfield. So kind of went really cautious in that first away game of the campaign. Probably a bit of fear, thinking, and, you know, if we go out here and get embarrassed, then I'm done for, kind of thing. So that surprised me. But then obviously going forward, I don't think he went so conservative like in Montpellier. He didn't really pick a conservative team, so he probably learned his lesson from that. But yeah, it just was in that era where you didn't really know anything about anyone else. You might have seen people like Valderrama a little bit at the World Cup, but yeah, you don't know everything about all of the players. Yeah. So that kind of makes it a bit more exciting.
Exotic. Like, you know, I maintained, you know, obviously how important it was, but it was a lesser trophy for Barcelona. I remember, you know, like seeing, I just naturally assumed that they'd sell out, they'd have thousands. But to them, it was a European Cup or bust. But for us, it was like not only back in Europe, but this, and like looking back, this fondness of the Cup Winners' Cup, you know, a trophy that doesn't even exist anymore.
Yeah, it was, yeah, I think definitely you look back on it with more fondness now as the years pass and as football becomes, you know, you look at the Champions League now and obviously everyone's happy to be back in the Champions League, but it's kind of, you know, a lot of the finals and you can probably predict sort of six of the eight quarterfinalists nowadays. It does become quite repetitive, and then you look back fondly at things like the Cup Winners' Cup where it was never retained by anyone. Barcelona won it three times, you know, so a couple of teams did win it more than once, but it was not really a competition that anyone dominated or that teams were in every year. So it was always kind of like a new field. And I always think that the random nature of the tournaments back then, where it was straight knockout, there was no seeding, you know, everyone just went into a hat and then you got pulled out, and that makes for a bit more of a random,
yeah,
quirky competition as well. So I think UEFA have tried to kind of rekindle it a bit with the Conference League, but it's not really the same.
Yeah.
So they've obviously realised that they've made a bit of an error, but yeah, you're never going to get the Cup Winners' Cup again. So it was a good cup. As you say, it was probably the secondary competition, and Barcelona had won it already before, I think a couple of years before, and they were going for the European Cup. So to them, it might have been, you know, not as much of a big deal. But
the mad thing, you know, they didn't even won the European Cup once. Then
yeah, that's point, just, yeah.
Next year, you know, like it's just bonkers, isn't it? You know, like that, like obviously parallel to us and the football is the music as well. So how do you look back at that, you know?
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed kind of looking at I still love all the music from sort of, you know, the late 80s, early 90s. I think you tend to gravitate between, you know, towards the music that was around when you grew up. So just looking back on, you know, which songs were out. Obviously, things like World in Motion and Pavarotti were, you know, they were just synonymous with the era, weren't they? And obviously, Sit Down and a few of the other songs. But yeah, I really enjoyed looking at. I looked at the charts from the whole season, really. So sort of August to May, I was looking at the charts to see what was number one. I made a Spotify playlist as well. There's some brilliant music out there. And I really found it interesting when I was looking at, you know, that the day after the final with the parade, and Pavarotti was doing a concert at the GMEX, which I didn't know until I was doing the research. And, you know, it just showed, you know, Pavarotti, apparently, I mean, because I was at the parade, but I was in sales, so I don't know what was going on in town. But you've got, like, in town, apparently, you've got football fans, then you've got people in tuxedos. and I think I wrote in the epilogue of the book, like, almost foreboding like what would happen in with football, you know, that gentrification. And Pavarotti apparently was at one point had a United scarf on and mentioned the triumph in his concert. So but yeah, no, some of the music is just legendary, isn't it, from that time.
What are your memories of sale? I know you touch upon it in the intro, but like, just
so I was, my dad had an office there just over from where the courts were, and so he had an office and on like the first floor, so we were just hanging out that window. And I wrote in the intro of the book, like, my mum had a sign saying, get your kit off Les Seeley, which I was like really embarrassed about at the time. Really embarrassed. I mean, we always talk about it now. Whenever we mention that, whenever the Cup Winners' Cup comes up, I always, you know, we always laugh about it now. I've no idea what she was doing, but
brilliant.
It was quite funny. It was quite funny. And then I also wrote in there as well that Les, who was, I couldn't write this in the book, I mean, basically he's a dwarf, but obviously, I don't know whether you can say that anymore or whatever, but the publisher made me take that word out of the book. So, but yeah, he was like from around where my nana lived, and he just kind of decided to, I don't know why he did it, but he was just cycling right down the middle of the road before the bus came, when it was, you know, the road was completely empty and everyone was cheering and he just sort of soaking it all up. You know, I remember that so vividly, those two things, the Les Seeley cardboard sign.
But there's a few photos, again, like people touched upon it this season in the mag, there's a few photos of the parade, and Rotterdam was probably the first final where people had more disposable cameras than they ever had, you know, like, so there's lots of photos of the United end and that, but that was a transformation, because you could just, you know, you'd be in bars wherever. I loved your book. So if one people read this, I absolutely loved your book on the intercontinental history of that. I mean, it was just fascinating for someone who's only dipped his toes in it with United. So how on the book, how do you go about researching something like If I Hadn't Seen Such Riches?
Yeah, it's kind of like, I think that's probably the part of it that I enjoy the most is sort of delving into all the research. But it does become quite overwhelming because you've obviously got like, must be 60 odd books that I went through, autobiographies and Andy Mitten's books and things like that. So you kind of go into all of the books you can find that have got some mention of this in it. And it's funny though, because and before I actually decided to write the book, one of the things I always do is look for similar books. And when I realised there was nothing specifically on this season, I was gobsmacked, you know. I mean, it was good for me because had there been something out there, I wouldn't have done it. So it was really kind of surprising. So, I mean, in some books that I looked at, it gets maybe mentioned a few lines. You know, they don't really go into it in that much detail. So I had to kind of pull as much as I could from all the autobiographies, etc. And then it's like looking through old footage, going, you know, looking through old newspaper archives. That was probably the richest source, because that's kind of happening.
Yeah.
You know, because we find as well that when you hear people speak years after an event as well, everyone has the same issue, but your memory plays tricks on you. So,
yeah,
it was different to what was in the newspapers at the time.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So it was really useful to get all the newspaper clippings of like the day before the game, the day of the game, the day after the game, you know, to see what people were saying before the game. To see what the feeling was in the press, like I said before, with the Montpellier game, where quite a few of the journalists were saying, "Oh, this is an example of naive English clubs have not been in Europe for 5 years. They've fallen behind, conceding the away goal, and they're going to go out now. And Aston Villa have gone out, and so you know all that. Feel kind of like what the mood was. I found that the newspapers were really.
Do you write it at the time, or do you do the research and then write?
I kind of write as I'm researching, but then obviously you kind of start off with a chapter outline, but then it changes hundreds of times during the process as well, and then something else will pop up and then you'll get a different idea, and then you'll rejig everything. So it is, there are always times during the process where you're a bit, you get a bit down and you've got just loads of words and how do I bring all this together? But yeah, you just have to keep
deadlines.
Going.
They're fuckers, yeah. Aren't they? What I loved about it is it brings to life, certainly for me reading it, just those off-field times. And, you know, like because I can say to people when the Busby thing, which I remember that, so he arrived in the two coaches, the players and the officials, and there was a frenzy of United fans in a nice way, but it became a frenzy that they had to use police dogs to get people back. It was almost like this pent up years of just, yes, you know, like, come on. And it was like, it's hard to, it comes to life that I can just, and just listening to sit down on my phone, you know, and straight away I'm transported back.
That's what I like to do. Like, yeah. I mean, for me, like the main kind of audience for the book is people like yourself who were around that time. You know, I really want, and I hope that anyone who went to the game or was around at that time reads it and kind of gets transported back. That was my primary thing. Obviously, but then there's also a new generation of people who might not even, they'll probably know about it, but they might not know anything about the detail of it. So I hope that they can read it as well. Just like when I read books about, you know, the 60s or the 70s, you know, it's kind of, you know about it, but you don't know the detail. So I'm hoping that people...
I think young and old will really... This is a two-prong back. Looking back, which one thing stands out the most? And how do you think history will record that season, that moment?
Yeah, I think how history will remember it. I think I hope that people kind of or history remembers it. I kind of feel like sometimes it falls between the cracks. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do the book. I guess for people that were there, it doesn't. But people always talk about the FA Cup in 1990. People then always talk about the sort of Premier League, you know, the Championship, you know, the first Premier League, 1993. And I feel like sometimes it does fall between the cracks. So I kind of, I'm not saying that my book is going to solve that problem, but I just wanted to put something out there that says, you know, there is something else that was just as, if not bigger than like the FA Cup, for example. Obviously not the league, but, you know, it was a key moment in the club's history and in also the trajectory of English football, really. So I hope kind of is remembered like that.
Yeah, because, you know, absence makes the heart go fonder. We weren't winning things. And I maintained, to bring it into a current era, seeing the title celebrations now, when United, you know, we joke about it, when United next win the league, it's going to be bedlam and carnage. But it will be, because it just tastes sweeter. You know, everything feels more raw, you know, like, so that was just a time, you know, the FA Cup meant so much.
And you don't get, like, you know, European trophies, they don't come round often, do they? And as you say, absence wise, in terms of, especially after not being in Europe at all, so let alone getting to a final, but not actually kicking a ball in Europe for 5 years.
Yeah,
just made it even sweeter to then go on and win the competition, but also against the top team. They may have had a couple of players missing, but, you know, they were still a class team, and they won the European Cup a year later. You know, legendary manager, and it wasn't. And one thing that I wanted to stress as well is that in the book is that it wasn't like a smash and grab or anything. It was a well deserved win.
Yeah,
obviously you get the 10 minutes at the end where Blackmore clears one off the line, and it's a bit frantic, and Les Sealy's obviously struggling. But it wasn't like a backs to the wall lucky win. It was 75% of the game was a dominant performance, really.
It just, every time Koeman got the ball, I'd absolutely shout myself, you know, like, and every time, don't give away a free kick. Right, so this is Dan Williamson. If I haven't seen Such Riches, please, say, plug it, get it on Amazon, you'll love it. It's a summer read, perfect. You won't like me for this as your final question, then. But what's next, then?
What, in terms of books?
Yeah.
I've not got any plans.
You've always got a plan.
No, honestly, I genuinely haven't, because, and I thought to myself, this might be my last book.
No.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. I probably will get to the point where I start getting the itch, but at the moment I'm just enjoying kind of doing things like this.
There's always another, Dan, right? The next title win, there you go. Look at all the subplots and to cover there.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I suppose there's certain things in the next few years that have been covered to death. So, you know, I don't want to just retread old ground, and you kind of have to add something new to the... You know, all of my books so far, you know, like going back to the Boca Juniors, my first book, which was the first history of Boca Juniors in English, like that filled some kind of gap, and the Cup Winners' Cup book did as well. So it's just about finding something that fills a gap.
Well, as I say, the Intercontinental, the things I didn't know, and just to be like not covered, you know, like in an era, no proper cameras, some of the madness that was covered, it's just, it's beautiful, isn't it? It's like, so we're also going to run a competition to win a prize. So how do people follow you? So they're going to follow me, follow, what account is it?
So my book account, I've got a personal account, but I've got a book account as well, which on Twitter is at CupWinnersCup91.
Okay, and I'll retweet that and we'll say how to do it. So one final plug for the book, Dan?
Yeah, no, I hope, if you've not got the book yet, I would love you to buy a copy and interact with me on Twitter, let me know how you found it. And if you have already got a copy, I hope you enjoyed it and hope I did it justice. It's been a couple of years of really hard work. I've tried to get as much detail in there as possible, while still making it readable. So, anyone listening, I hope you enjoy the book.
And a Fergie-like, I don't deserve this honour, but well done, mate. Well done. Seriously. It brought back so many memories, as you say, and nice to go down memory lane. Thanks for everything, and thanks for doing this, Dan. Really appreciate it. And take care. See you later. And thanks, everyone. Cheers, mate.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye. And then that was lovely. So get the book. And also just one final plug for the campaign. And we've got one more podcast to come, which will be next week, which is our end of season review, which we did last week, but is a bit of fun. And it's got a Coggy competition. But say thanks to everyone who supported the campaign. We're nearly halfway there, which is just so humbling. But get us over the line, please. So get to the 40th year. Michael Carrick's staying. Sensible move if we couldn't get Enrique. It seems it's a logical step. Now let's make logical moves in the transfer market. Let's get a really couple of good midfielders. And let's dream a little, because it's nice dreaming rather than being moaning. Take care of yourselves and enjoy the sunshine, Reds.